Okay, we'll call to order the House Revenue Committee. Welcome our members and special guest Representative Hobson joining us. Your committee is shut down.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just bored.
I thought she was bringing amendments on behalf of Tillamook County or something.
I'll mention right now, if anyone is here on 519, we will not be going to any votes on that today. I will take testimony, so if there are people here in the audience testifying on 519, Joan, would you please set out a sign-up sheet? We'll ask anyone to sign up on 519 who might want to speak on that. Otherwise, we will take that up on Friday, committee, and plan on working it on Friday. But if there's anyone here to speak to it today, I'll take public testimony.
I'll take testimony.
With that said, let's begin with a work session on Senate Bill 521. Who's that? Ed, is that you? Ed? Looking at this, we last heard this in March. So would you please bring us up to date? Yeah, 521.
Senate Bill 521 makes some changes to the business energy tax credit program. It has a anticipated revenue impact of about $1.1 million in 0103. None of that is anticipated in the governor's or co-chair's current budget deliberations.
You mean in any published budget?
Exactly.
Yeah. I think, though, that based on my meetings with the co-chairs, the understanding is that they are prepared to accommodate 521 in anticipation that it would come out of this committee and across the floor. So it's not in the published budget, but they're expecting it, I guess I would say that.
Looking for a motion?
I am.
Chairman, I would move Senate Bill 521A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Are there no amendments?
No amendments.
Okay. All right. Representative Beck moves Senate Bill 521 to the floor as, I'm sorry, without amendment by this committee, just the way it came from the Senate. Is there discussion on that motion? Okay, please call the roll, Joan.
Representative
Beck.
Aye.
Beck.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Half.
Aye.
Williams.
Aye.
Webb.
Aye.
Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Safari.
Excused.
Chair
Shatterly. Votes aye. Senate Bill 521 goes to the floor. I have a volunteer, Representative Beck. You want to carry this?
I'd love to.
Okay. Then Senate Bill 521 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 520. And I'll say both with reference to this and 521, these were a couple of bills that we were holding since we heard them in March, pending the May forecast and the way things are going to look. And at this point, again, confirming as to this bill as well as the last, the co-chairs are anticipating they'll be able to accommodate this in the budget, and I think the governor is expecting the same. So, Ed, will you just give us the overview again on 520?
Senate Bill 520A makes some changes, eliminates sunset dates relating to the residential energy income tax credit, the alternative energy system property tax exemption, and the energy conservation lenders income tax credit. It has a anticipated revenue impact of about $2.42 million in 0103. Approximately $1.8 million of that is anticipated in the governor's budget.
Okay. Again, same thing. This was held pending the receipt of the forecast and anticipation being that it will be accommodated in the budget. Is there any discussion on this before we take a motion? Representative Witt.
I make a motion.
Sure,
Mr. Chairman.
You bet.
I move Senate Bill 520A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Witt moves Senate Bill 520A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Okay, please call the roll.
Representative
Faye. Aye.
Beck.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Half.
Aye.
Williams.
Aye.
Webb.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Safari.
Excused.
Chair Shatterly.
Aye. Senate Bill 520 A goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Witt, that was your motion. You want to carry this one?
I'd be fine, Mr.
All right. Well, we've got a bipartisan energy policy coming out of the Revenue Committee. Senate Bill 520A goes
better
to the floor.
Better than a federal energy policy.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask one quick question?
Yes, you may.
Now that we're done voting on it.
Okay.
There was about 620,000 different between what the governor recommended and what the revenue impact was. Did we go over what that...
I'm not sure about the difference, except that they... I think that between the governor's office and the chair, it's not material.
Right, okay. Great. All right, thank you.
Okay, I'm going to skip over Senate Bill 519 for right now. I don't see anyone signed up on that. Okay, so let's go to Senate Bill 397 and open a work session on that. And let me invite those folks who stopped me in the hall. Where are you? There's Lisa Trussell. Who wants to go first?
Tim? Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Tim Nesbitt with the Oregon AFL-CIO. In regards to Senate Bill 397, you heard objections from us several weeks ago. Since then, several things have happened. One, following the revenue forecast, there was a new calculation by the Employment Department of the rates that employers will be paying over the next 4 years. That projected a higher level of employer payments. And in the same regard, they also found that there'll be more of a margin of funding available in each of the schedules in future years under Senate Bill 397. And given the coincidence of those two changes, we've managed to reach agreement with AOI for support of our bill to extend benefits to dislocated workers. And in return, we're supporting this bill. Its reduction in rates is now more moderate. It's against a higher level of employer payments. And it's no longer in conflict with the benefit improvements we're hoping to accomplish this session. So we definitely support this bill now and hope that, like our bill, it can be referred to Ways and Means and the two can proceed apace thereafter. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries. We have appreciated very much working with AFL-CIO on this bill and their dislocated worker bill, and appreciate the committee is holding the bill for a little bit for us to get things worked out. And support.
Always happy to hold things until they get worked out. Next session, if I'm back, I'm not going to move anything until end of May. Because it all gets worked out. In a dream. Okay, so I want to underscore your recommendation or request, even though we do not have a subsequent referral on this bill. The other bill that you're looking to pair this with and move is in Ways and Means. You are pleased to have this go to Ways and Means so it can be paired with that bill and they move out together?
Mr. Chair, 397 will actually have to wait a little longer, but we would like them both to go to the governor together.
Okay. So. And Paul tells me that this is a bill that in sessions past has been a Ways and Means bill, a regulatory bill, so that seems consistent with previous practices to do that, and along with, especially with your concurrence on that recommendation. Are there any questions and no further amendments then from the bill as it came to us? Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Well, in that case, then the chair would move Senate Bill 397 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means at the request of the stakeholders. Is there a any discussion on that motion? Okay, please call the roll.
Representative
Say. Aye.
Taft.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Aye.
Williams. Aye.
Weah.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Safari.
Aye.
Chair Shatterly.
Aye. Senate Bill 397 then goes to the floor with a due pass, subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Okay, thanks very much. And I will put in my two cents and work with you folks to let the co-chairs know that that's the recommendation of the committee that it be popped out with the other bill. Okay. Thank you. Close the work session on Senate Bill 397. Is Representative Worth coming down? Where is she? Yeah, why don't you go ahead and get her?
Choo-choo bill?
Yeah, we'll do that.
What else is he going to now?
No, that's what it's about.
Where were you going?
How was going there?
When you go down, would you hand that to Mr. Warner?
We're pulling out the station here that we're doing.
I share this with Representative Hoffman.
We have testimony here signed up. Also, open a public hearing on House Bill 3127. Elizabeth, if you could tell us where we are on this one.
Hey, Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 3127, we've had a working group that has been discussing the railroad property tax exemption, and basically, again, what it does is it provides a the original bill provided a 10-year property tax exemption for newly constructed and installed railroad tracks or newly acquired equipment used primarily for the maintenance of railroad lines. And what you have before you is a Dash 5 amendment, and that is from the working group. And that Dash 5 decreases the property tax exemption from 10 years to 5 years.
Wait, Dash 5?
Yep.
Do we all have Dash 5?
No. In the file.
I do.
All right. Oh, yes, there we are. Thank you.
Okay. The Dash 5 and the Dash 3 were handed out the last meeting when we didn't really hear the bill. So one of the changes with the Dash 5 is it's decreasing that property tax exemption from 10 years to 5 years, so from the discussions of the working group.
This is surreal.
Again, the property tax exemption applies to improvements on existing railroad property that's placed in service after the assessment date of 2002-03, but the... this Dash 5 puts a sunset on that, and so that there's a 10-year sunset now, so the new equipment and improvements must be finished by July 1st of 2012. Another change that the work group made was that the exemption originally just applied to Class 2 and 3, those short line railroads, or property that is owned or leased by the short line railroads. But what we're doing in the Dash 5 is we're then allowing now Class 1 railroads and property that's owned or leased by Class 1 railroad, if it is used in whole or part as a commuter rail service. And that was due to some discussions about a commuter rail line in Washington County. So that's another change. Again, what these railroad companies do is they apply to the Department of Revenue by March 15th each year and identify that newly constructed or installed acquired property during the preceding calendar year, and then that becomes the amount that is property tax exempt for that given year. And again, it goes for 5 years with the Dash 5 amendment.
Okay. Let's see. Let's bring up, Debbie, do you want to just refer to this, or are we going to let Barbara do that? Okay. Former Representative Barbara Ross, welcome back again.
Thank you.
Wayne, are you in the room? Wayne Giese. Not here. Okay.
Thank you for the chance to be here. I understand that Representative Worth is in the middle of a vote down in her committee, and so you're having passed out before you the testimony that she had prepared for you. And I think just the basic thing is that this bill came out of a work group that people got together, they compromised, and I think the people that were at the work group were, as you have listed here, the people who participated, and they are all satisfied with the result. And staff has told you what the bill does. I'll be happy to answer any questions, but I would urge you to go ahead and move this so that we can get it to the Senate side and get them to act on it, because I think it is very good for local businesses, and it helps to keep these short lines in repair so that they can provide the transportation that's needed, keep trucks off our road, keep the rail cars full.
Okay. Thank you. Are there questions for former Representative Ross? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Former Representative Ross, hello.
Thank you.
My question is do we have some reason to believe that some improvements are going to come about because of this legislation? And if so, what can you tell us about that?
Well, Congressman DeFazio is working to get a $350 million allocation for short-line railroad repair across the country. And Oregon, because we are the state with the longest number of miles, that allocation will be distributed based on the number of miles, and Oregon has more lines of short-line railroads than any other state. And so we will get a piece of that. And it's important when that comes to the states, those be able to be used by the lines that are in worst need of repair and that are the most likely to be repaired without this disincentive if people feel I wouldn't have the money to pay the taxes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Walter Brickwettle. He's not here either.
Well,
who signed these people up?
I think they signed up at the previous hearing.
Really? Oh, you're right. You know, this is the May 16 that's got that crossed out and May 21. All right. Okay. Claudia Howells, you're here. Nope.
Claudia was.
What's that?
There she is. Here she is.
Okay, Claudia.
Magically appeared. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Thank you, Barbara.
I know if I tried to grab lunch.
Lunch. You can have lunch around mid-June.
Or, Mr. Chair, you could be like Representative Beck and bring your lunch to committee.
Yeah. I've been downwind of that a couple times.
I'll see. We're kind of loving family.
Honey, you're welcome.
Oh, my. Thank you. Chair Shetterly, members of the committee. I'm Claudia Howells. I manage ODOT's rail division. I'm here today to address House Bill 3127, which, as you know, relates to the taxation of railroad property. ODOT's rail division has a statutory responsibility to represent customers of railroads and the public generally on issues related to the railroad industry. A specific mission in our laws is to make every reasonable effort to preserve rail service, particularly in rural parts of the state. The purpose, as you know, of HB 3127 is to alleviate, and I think whoever corrected this should elevate, and I apologize for that,
just like
some of the disincentive for railroads to make capital improvements in railroad infrastructure. It is our hope that this will encourage railroads to continue operating some lines that might otherwise be abandoned. Oregon is unique among states in that over half of the railroad miles are operated by short-line railroads. There's only really one other state in the country that's somewhat similar, and that's the state of Kansas. Over half of Oregon rail-served producers are located on short-line railroads. The short lines are an essential part of the state's transportation system. A short line railroad is a term that applies to the smaller, independent railroads that connect to the big railroads. The Surface Transportation Board, the federal agency with jurisdiction over some aspects of railroading, classifies railroads as 1, 2, and 3. By the way, we use Roman numerals because the Federal Railroad Administration classifies track, and they talk in terms of 1 through 6 class track, and they use Arabic numerals. And they're actually talking about that the worst kind of track is Class 1, whereas Class 1 railroads are the big railroads. So it's almost the opposite in terms of how you look at it. Short lines, and this is referenced in the bill, are referred to as either, and this is a mistake too, as Class 2 or 3 railroads. Oregon has 20 short lines. Some are owned by large international corporations, some by families, some by the primary shipper, some by local governments. Since 1994, when a major part of the system transferred from Class 1 operation to Class 3, all the short lines have dramatically improved customer service, increased traffic, and invested enormous amounts of money in capital improvements. Many of these lines still suffer from years of deferred maintenance. Despite considerable investment, some continue in fragile condition. for lines that are producing minimal revenue that are probably more important to the Oregon economy than the railroad's economic benefit, there is little in the way of support or incentive for the railroads to invest in infrastructure improvements. In fact, the method of taxing railroad properties can create a disincentive to making those needed capital investments. In summary, HB 2137 is consistent with ODOT's statutory direction and the guidance from the Oregon Transportation Commission as contained in the Oregon Transportation Plan. And we appreciate the efforts of the sponsors in helping to find creative ways to support the railroads that serve the rural parts of our state.
Thank you. Questions from Ms. Howells? Well, Representative Worth is making her way to the, although your testimony has been presented, did you want to come up and say anything again? Okay. All right, thank you, Claudia. Elizabeth, we have the dash fives, and then, as I understand, those are the only amendments that are before us actually for consideration. Okay, for consideration. We are. Representative Kufori?
I move the dash five amendments to House Bill 3127.
Representative Kufori moves the dash five amendments to House Bill 3127. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Therein?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kufori.
I move House Bill 3127 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kufori moves House Bill 3127 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Please call the roll.
Representative
Kay. Aye.
Yeah.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Pass.
Aye.
Williams.
Aye.
Whip.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Aye.
Kufori.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3127 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Carrier?
Representative Worth.
Yeah. Worth. Do you want to carry this?
Sure.
Okay. Representative Worth. Very good. Representative Barnhart, did I see him in the room? Just a vision. Okay. Thank you, Elizabeth. All right. Well, then let's go on to HJR 64. We've got a little testimony on that one. Don Arnold and John Lilly, did you cross yourselves off? Okay. Make sure someone wasn't playing games with the sign-up sheet. Okay, we'll open a work session on, a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 64. Paul, do you want to bring us up to date on that?
Chair, the HJR 64 grew out of a discussion the committee had some time ago looking at stabilization funds. And what HJR 64 does is authorize the legislature to use the principal of common school fund for education purposes under certain conditions. And those conditions were laid out to reflect an economic recession. Two issues came up during the hearing. One was what was the state's responsibility as managing it as a trust, and the other issue was the lands that became the basis of the Common School Fund initially were from the Admissions Act from the federal government, and what were the legal issues surrounding the availability of revenue from that, and that's where the committee left that issue, and then we have an amendment to HJR 64 that proposes changes from Representative Witt, and we also have Greg Chamoff to talk about that amendment.
Representative Witt, do you want to make some comments first?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Briefly, after our last discussion on HJR 64, I met, I believe, three or four times with Paul Warner and Greg Chamoff. And we discussed both the constitutional issues, the Federal Admissions Act issues, and then we also discussed this issue that you raised, Mr. Chairman, namely the requirement for the legislature to pay back any money that it uses in a period of a certain number of years following the end of the economic downturn. And from that discussion, Mr. Chamoff has given us a pretty strong legal opinion that there's definitely a way of doing this without running afoul of either federal law or constitutional requirements relative to trusts, and that's in the dash 2 amendments to this bill. And then we also incorporated in the dash 3 amendments the requirement that the legislature would have to pay any principal back in a period of the succeeding three biennia after the economic downturn ceases to exist. So, and I think Mr. Chamoff is going to come and discuss the -2 amendments and specifically the federal law issue and the constitutional issues.
Do you want to do that now, and then we'll reserve you for closing? Why don't you come on, just to, why don't you go ahead and just, as they've been referred to, and walk us through the -2s in particular. And like I say, we'll reserve you for rebuttal.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the -2 amendments do two things. First, they remove the proceeds from the Admissions Act lands from the stabilization fund. Those lands were given to the state with the understanding that the state would hold them or their proceeds in perpetuity to fund schools, and under federal law, you may not dip into that particular asset. The -2 amendments also carve out bequests that the state would have received up until the time of the adoption of the amendment that the measure proposes, because those would have been monies that the state would have received with at least an implicit understanding that they would be maintained purely for school fund purposes.
I guess this may be a question for DSL or for Treasury, but just to make certain that we can identify those funds that are described as the proceeds in paragraph A of subsection 1.
Mr. Chair, that would be a question for DSL or Treasury.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll hear more later. Let me bring up in Brian Reeder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of this committee. I'm Brian Reeder from the Department of Education. I primarily simply want to state the department's support for the creation of a stabilization fund for education. We believe that using the common school fund in that manner is consistent with the intent of the Constitution. And we understand there's some thorny legal issues that need to be worked out, but we do want to express our support for some sort of fund, and to think that use of the common school fund, either principal if it is repaid or the income, the investment income from the fund for stabilization purposes, is a good idea, and we would support that.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Reeder? Thank you very much. Ann Hannes and Kevin Chuba. Mr. Chuba, how'd you like the second act the other night?
It was fabulous. How did you like it, sir?
Kept me awake. It's an opera. We were ran into each other at the opera. Okay, please proceed.
It was a lowbrow opera.
Yeah. A lowbrow.
Yeah,
Portland.
Oh.
You have one. You have one, you know. Please.
Thank you, Chair Shutterly. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ann Hannes. I'm the director of the Division of State Lands. With me today is Kevin Chuba with the Justice Department. Let me start off by talking about legal and policy issues connected with HJR 64, because I think it's important to look at both of those issues raised by this bill. I think it's also important to state that I believe that it's very beneficial to have a rainy day fund, especially during economic downturns, as a way to buffer potential cuts. But we are concerned, however, about whether or not using the common school fund is the appropriate vehicle for that, because of potential impacts to future generations as well as the legal risks to the state. In terms of impact to future generations, the Common School Fund was established as a permanent fund to benefit the children of yesterday, today, and tomorrow. We mentioned in testimony that we gave before that there are legal and policy case to argue that the Common School Fund has evolved into such a permanent fund. And the Attorney General has issued opinions concluding that it's the state's obligation to maintain the Common School Fund as a permanent trust. In so doing, the land board members as trustees are obligated to maximize the long-term benefit to the schools because of the trust. Now, on the policy side, that deals with question of whether or not you benefit today's kids at the expense of future kids. If you tap heavily in the fund today for permanent or temporary purposes, future distributions will likely be lower in subsequent years because either there's not enough as much money in the principal to generate earnings, or because our investment strategy has to change away from higher yield instruments. For example, right now, about 60% of the Common School Fund is invested in stocks, and thus, when you have a downturn, you'd be selling on the low end of the market most likely, and as well as you'd have to switch to an investment strategy that would have more liquid investments in the fund. Now, I think it'd be safe to say, probably, that if you'd had the Common School Fund available during the fiscal crisis of the early 1980s, you probably wouldn't have the size of the Common School Fund that we have today. And right now, that roughly depends. It's somewhere between $700 and $800 million, given where the stock market is. The schools in this current biennium had $71 million that they benefited from that fund. It basically, with this bill, you would, I think, would be converting a perpetual stream of revenue for schools into a source that would be for permanent or short-term fix. With regard to the potential legal risk to the state, the Justice Department has highlighted those legal issues, and there have been cases throughout the western states that have underscored the trust nature of the Common School Fund lands, and that the Common School Fund Trust were established by those different states following the Emissions Act. I think it would not be out of line to say that you, and I probably should turn this over to Kevin to make this statement, but you could be facing a legal risk similar to what the legislature had when they used the SAFE Fund back in the early 1980s and then had to repay that. All of that being said, I think there might be a way that I think it would be worth examining in the interim if there's ways that we could use future earnings or future revenues of the common that go into the Common School Fund that might be used to help fill up a rainy day fund. I think that's something we'd have to examine and use the next year or so to look at some of the policy and legal issues connected with that, and then we could come back and bring a recommendation back to the legislature in terms of that, because I think that, you know, there might be a way that we could use some receipts that way to help start filling up, as well as I think the governor had proposed legislation that would also use lotteries. So maybe the combination of using some different sources could build up a sizable rainy day fund for the schools. Turning to the amendments that are been proposed, some things to consider with regard to those amendments. On the Dash 2 amendments, if you're limiting the source of the revenues that go into the Economic Stabilization Fund to basically the statutory revenues, in we're projecting, for example, in the next biennium that gross statutory revenues would amount to about $5 million. Compared to the constitutional revenues that amount to about $40 million and the investment income that amounts to about $80 million. So it'd be a relatively small share of the revenues that go into the fund.
I don't accept that.